Okay, good morning. Our learning this morning is sponsored both by Mark and Chani Shaina in memory of Mark's mother, Rhoda Shaina, Rachel, by Yitzchak Chaim Aleiha Shalom, and also in memory of Seth Friedman's grandmother, Genendol Bat Aaron, which is sponsored by Ilan and Seth Friedman. The Shemot should have the outlet. Learning will be in their memory. May their memory continue to be a blessing. So we are officially doing Daf Yud Gimel. We're at the bottom of Yud Bet, Amud Bet. We are still laying the groundwork of Megillat Esther. So far, we have identified Achashverosh as a willing participant in the end of Jewish hopes of return to Israel. He is not, as we've laid out so far, interested in the wholesale destruction of the Jewish people. That will come through the initiative of Haman, which we'll get to at the end of today. But he is interested in ending any hope the Jews have of returning to their land, of disintegrating their place and their roots in Persia, where they are now. And that's what the party is about. The party is about establishing the 70 years have transpired. The hopes that your exile will end are over. And now you can settle and become part and assimilate into our kingdom. And we were given a sense of who he was, the ambitions that he had, that he shared with Nebuchadnezzar to have supreme rule over the ancient world. We described in detail what the party looked like with the jewels and the gold and the silver and the views and the location. And we got to the very end of Yud Bet Amud Bet, having discussed why the king wanted Vashti to come. He had gotten drunk. This was a Shabbat where Jews usually begin their parties with discussions of law and uplifting stories. It's discussed that the Persians had the tradition of beginning with lewd remarks and brought the state of the affair into the gutter, which led the king to say, well, why don't you all look at my wife? I'll prove to you that it's not the Medians, it's not the Persians who are the finest looking. My wife will come, and they say, okay, but only one condition, that she's undressed. And he says, yeah, I'm fine with that. But Vashti's not interested in coming, even though she's lewd by nature. And we said the reason was, Chazal presume, either she broke out in a skin condition or she had sprouted a tail. And then there was animosity between the couple because Achashverosh had come and she said, who do you think you are? You're the stable boy of my king. And he could drink for days on end. And, it, you know, he had what they call a hollow leg. Thank you. So he didn't affect him. And you've been drinking for a week and you're already telling your wife to come and display herself to other people. Who do you think you are? Which one he gets really angry. He then turns to who for advice?
Muhan.
Well, Muhan inserts himself in the advice. He turns to the rabbis. He turns to the elders, the sages. And the rabbis say, you know what? We're a displaced people. We're in exile. And it sounds strategic that they're saying this, but we said it might reflect a sensibility of the rabbis generally. We don't rule in life and death affairs when we're not on our land. We don't have the stability of mind and the confidence to make these assessments. So turn to the Moabites or other people who've been on their land for long enough. And at this point, all the advisors jump in, Mumuchan being the last one, and he offers the assailing advice, you should send a letter to everybody in the kingdom demonstrating that husbands are in charge. And we said, actually, that was a strategic blunder on the part of Haman, because that deadened the effect of the second note, which was kill all the Jews. Because having received a note in every household saying the husbands are in charge, all the husbands said, yeah, we know. What are you talking about? Even the stable boys in the kingdom, even the carpenters, the menial laborers in the kingdom have sway in their homes, so I don't know why the king feels the need to do this. And then they get a second note later in the story saying you should kill all the Jews. And I think, oh, this guy's bonkers. You know, when you get multiple letters from people running for office, at some point you stop paying attention to these letters. We're good. that we stop paying attention to repeated notes. So it kind of dulled the impact of that second note. So we're at the bottom of Yud Bet Amud Bet. And now that we have done the first parak, essentially, we pivot into the second, where we meet Mordechai and Esther. And we're going to be given a sense of their personality, their background, their persona, their ambitions, their traits. And we'll finish reflecting on this stuff, that God, this also comes up in Fiddle on the Roof, God provides the cure before he provides the curse, the refuah, the healing before the makah. And that's what we're getting here, a sense that things are falling into place, that should terrible things happen, we'll have salvation as a possibility. So bottom of Yud Bet Amud Bet, I know some of you don't have it in front of you, so I'll read it out. It's only a few lines. And you'll be familiar with this. It's the opening verse of chapter 2. Ish Yehudi aya b'Shushan HaBirah. There was a Ish Yehudi, meaning a Jew. What does Yehudi mean usually?
From the tribe of.
A Judean. There was a man of Judah, or we translate it as a Jew, from Shushan HaBirah. His name was Mordechai ben Yair ben Kish Ish Yemini, who was a Benjaminite. So he's a Judah, or he's a Benjamin. What tribe is he from? That'll be the question. My karma, what is being told as we're introduced to Mordechai and all these details? If this is to provide his genealogy, give it all. Meaning you said it's Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish, and then you miss a number of generations and say Ishimini. If you're doing his genealogy, go all the way. Why do you break off after four generations? So Elamai Shnahani, what is all this about? It can't be just genealogy. Tanakulan on Shmo, it's to tell you that his name indicates his character. And all four of these names are subtle allusions to how he had an impact. Nigru ben Yair, he's called ben Yair because ben Shahir, a name shall Yisrael filato, because he enlightened the Jewish people. It's not just that he was a son of Yair, but he was a person of enlightenment to the Jewish people. Ben Shimi, why was he called the son of Shimi? Ben Shashamal filato, because his prayers were heard. Ben Kish, why was he called Kish? He Kish al Sheri Shamayim, because he knocked on the doors of heaven and they were open for him. So he is an ambassador of the Jewish people to God. He gets them to pray. He enlightens them with prayer. He has the door open for him. Kari lo Yehudi. And now we say, hold on a minute. He was called Yehudi. Alma Miyuda Kari. Sounds like he's from Judah. Kari lo Yemini. And he's called Yemini. Alma Mibinyamin Kati. So who's he from? Is he Jewish or is he Benjaminish? That's the question. Nachman says, Mordechai Muchta bin Amuso Haya, neither indicate which tribe he was from. We're just crowning him with names. He was a Judahite. He was a Benjaminite. These are wonderful associations that we just kind of label him. That's Rav Nachman. We're going to have four different answers as to why he's given both. Tal Zamar Rav Bachanam Rav Yeshua ben Levi. Avmer Binyamin ve'imam Yuda. Well, let's split the difference. He was half from each tribe. His mother was from Judah, but his father was from Benjamin. So what tribe is he associated with? Aviv from Binyamin, so his father's from Binyamin, so he's a Benjaminite, but we want to reference his mother's legacy as well. Rabbanan Amri, the Rabbanan say, actually, we know he's only from one tribe. He was from Benjamin. That's the tribe he was associated with. We've just said that's his father. But each tribe wanted to claim him as theirs. Mishpacha Midgarazu Bazu, the different tribes would kind of clash with each other. And this Mishpacha Yuda Omeret, the Judahites would say, the Judeans, I guess, Ana Garim Demitlan Mordechai, we own him because it's only because of Judah that Mordechai was born. Because Delokatle David Leshimi Ben Gera, because in David's last days, which tribe was David from? Judah, he's the king from the line of Judah. So he decided in his last days that Shimon ben Gera shouldn't be killed. Shimon ben Gera is from Benjamin, and he's an ancestor of Mordechai. And he was worthy of being put to death by the king for rebelling against David. And David says, keep Shimon ben Gera alive. And only because of that, Mordechai was born. So he said, he's really a Judah, because if it wasn't for us, he wouldn't be here. Mishpacha Binyamin Amar, and the Benjaminites said, Minai Kati, that's very nice, you know, lovely move on the part of David, but he's from Benjamin, so he's out. Rava, who presumably had difficult experiences in the rabbinate, said, "Knesset Yisrael and Relahech Yisrael." Now, it's not that they were claiming, the Judahs were claiming he's ours, and the Benjamins were claiming he was ours. The entire people were blaming each of those tribes for Mordechai's role in their demise. Because what did Mordechai do that caused the Jews' problem? He didn't bow down. Just bow down, be quiet, and we'll be fine. So they said, Mordechai is the one causing these problems. And not, of course not Mordechai alone. Haman's also got a complicity. But everyone was complaining. Instead of claiming who belongs to who, they were kind of defaming them. Last line on the Yud Bet Amud Bet. Ra'u ma'aseh li Yehudah. See what Judah did for me. Ma'aseh li Yehudah. And see what the Benjaminites do to me, the people would say. Ma'aseh li Yehudah. See what the Judahites do to us. Top of the page, Yud Gimel Amud Aleph. Now, Delokatli David Lishimi. Because David didn't kill Shimi, Yishlamimine Mordechai. Mordechai was born in Miknebe Haman. And he keeps inciting Haman. So actually, he is a Judean, and it's your fault, Judah, that we've got this problem. Marshi Lamli Yemini, and it's not only, it was also the Benjaminites. Why? Delo Katle Shaul Agag, because Shaul was from Benjamin, didn't kill Agag, Chitshalamine Haman, and because of that, Haman was born. Why is it Shaul's fault, by the way, that Agag had a son? He let Agag live when he was told to kill all the Amalekites. He let the king live Agag. Was Agag let to go off and live out the rest of his life? What happened to Agag? Anyone familiar with the story? Yeah, it was about a few minutes later. He's standing there and he says, Shaul, Shmuel arrives, the prophet, and says, "Why? What is this bleating I hear? I hear sheep out there that you didn't kill, and the king's over here." At which point, Shaul starts to defend himself, and Shmuel's not interested. He takes out his sword, and he kills Agag. So, he didn't get to live forever. Presumably, the descendants that would have Haman already born, why is it Benjamin's fault? So, it turns out, according to rabbinic legend, it was that night, after Shaul had decided not to kill him, the day before Shmuel had executed him, they had a relationship that produced Haman. So, there was a small window at which he produced the descendants that would lead to Haman, and Shaul acted improperly. Which is another defense for the rabbis on why Shmuel instructed Shaul to do this. It wasn't just a vicious, we don't like these people, but we're actually trying to save the future, potential destruction, devastation of everything. And that's why, and he failed in that regard, and that's why we blame the Benjaminites. So that's why it's called Ish Yehudi and an Ish Yemini. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, fourth line. Yochanan says, I've got a different answer. Lo lamijamin kati, he was from Benjamin. His mother wasn't from Judah. He was just purely Benjamin. Vamekar le Yehudi, and why is he called Yehudi? Why is he called a Jew? Al shum chakafar about avodah zarah, because he rejected idolatry. Shekol hakofer avodah zarah nekra Yehudi. Whoever rejects idolatry is called a Yehudi. Kedichtiv, as it says in the book of Daniel, iti guvin Yehudayim. Anyone know where that phrase guvin Yehudayim comes up? Yeah, you probably hear it said occasionally. You know, people tend to phase out at that point. But this is, when we say the rules of Jewish men in the Ketubah, Isi Guvin Yehudayim, this is in Aramaic in the book of Daniel, describing the three peers of Daniel who were thrown into the furnace for refusing idolatry. They're called Jews. And the assumption here is they're not from Judah. Or if they are from, there's a debate whether they're from Judah or not. And maybe they are from Judah, but that's not relevant. So the fact they're being called Judeans in this moment is a suggestion. This is not just a tribal affiliation. And this is also the rabbis writing at a time where everybody's called a Judean. They live in a place called Babylon. They were exiled from a place called Judea. So they were understood that we are all called Judah, even if you're not from the tribe of Judah, because we reject idolatry. Now, what you've got in the red here is a parenthesis or an aside that defends this position, that if you reject idolatry, you're called a Jew. And who is going to be the archetype Jew who defies idolatry? That's what you would think, Avraham. But he's never called a Yehuda. He's called an Ivri. So he's not called a Judah or Judahite. I mean, we could stand here for a while. I'm willing to bet that no one would guess this. She came up. That's a clue, by the way. She came up of the last few parashiot.
What did it begin with and what does it end with now?
Oh, good. Begins with Ba and ends with Tia. So we're talking about Batya or Bitya. And we're now going to read a pasuk from Divrei Yamim from Chronicles that seems very convoluted. A lot of genealogy, a large family. And the conclusion is going to be, it is essentially a very complicated verse that says one thing. Batya raised Moses. That's all it says. There's going to be 14 names, and we're going to say, oh, all those names are talking about these two people, and there's a reason all these names are used. So, last narrow line. Rav Shimon ben Pazi says, Ki hava pasuk b'divrei yamim. When he would introduce the book of Chronicles, Amahachi, he would say as follows, Kol devarecha echad heim. All your words are one. Vanu yodin adarshan, and we know how to expound them. If any of you have ever read through Chronicles, it's a winding history from essentially the dawn of time to the end of the Davidic line, and it can be quite complicated. Names come up that don't come up elsewhere in Tanakh. Stories are described in slightly different ways. And Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi says, there seems like there are complications, but I know that there is a unified message here, and I know how to expound it. So he goes on and he says, let me give you an example. There is a verse that says, Ishto ha-Yehudiyah, this Judean wife, Yalda at Yered, gave birth to Yered. Avi Gedur, who was the father of Gedur, Ve'et Chaver, and she gave birth to Chever, who was Avi Socho, who was the father of Socho, Ve'et Yekutiel Avi Zenoach, and also to Yekutiel, who was the father of Zenoach. So we're now being told this Judean wife gave birth to Yered, Chever, and Yekutiel, who were the father of these other figures that nobody knows who we're talking about. Again, in a minute we're going to say, all this is saying is she gave birth to Moses, who is given six different titles here. Ve'elu b'nei Batya bat Paro, and these are the children of Batya, the daughter of Pharaoh, Shelekach Mered, who married to Mered. Anyone know who Batya married, according to tradition? It begins with Ka and ends with Lev. Yes, Kalev. So according to tradition, she marries Kalev. But here we've been told you've got this Judean wife who gives birth to Yered, to Chever, and Yekutiel. And these are the children of Batya, the daughter of Pharaoh, who married Mered. And Rav Shimon ben Pazi is saying, seems complicated. Let me tell you what it all means. So yes, there's also a suggestion that maybe Miriam married Kalev. Yeah, it's not straightforward. But that's the tradition we're going with at the moment. So, Amai Kari Le Yehudia. Why is Batya here? It's clearly talking about Batya because it says at the end, these are the children of Batya. And at the beginning of the verse, it says this woman, Yehudian, gave birth to them. So why is she called a Yehudia? Al-Shem Shekafra B'Avodah Zarah, because she rejected Avodah Zarah. So this is defending the point we just made. You're called a Jew if you reject idolatry. And that's what she did. How do I know Batya rejected idolatry? Where is that indicated anywhere in the verse? We know that she saved Moses. How do we know that she rejected idolatry? What is the only detail we know about the beginning of her life? How does she find Moses? She goes down to bathe at the river. Sounds like she's just interested in hygiene. She went down to bathe at the river. Why is she going to bathe at the river? If you're a queen or a princess, you presumably have access to indoor facilities. Why is she going down to the river? He went to relieve himself.
Right, because he was trying to prove that he was a god.
Right, so why does she go down?
She's defeating that thesis.
That could be. She's showing we're not gods. And there's a theological edge to that. So if you look, I'm Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says, why does she go down to the river? She goes down to cleanse herself miglule beit avia, of the idolatry of her father. And there again, there's suggestions. Rashi, in another Gemara, suggests that she went down to do tefillah. She was using the river as a mikveh to convert, to shift her allegiances. But she's not going to bathe because she wants hygiene, it's a suggestion. She's going down because she's rejecting her father's path, which is borne out by what she does next, which is save a Jewish baby. So that's the indication. That's why she's called Yehudia. Yalda, but it says she gave birth to Moses. She did not give birth to Moses. And there's a very important teaching of Aribur Rebite. She only raised him. She didn't give birth. Lo malachim is tell to shekol ha-magadol yatom b'yotom ha-betoch beito. Whoever raises an orphan in their home, ma'la alav ha-katav kilo yaldo. It's as if you gave birth to them. There is something about raising children that is as profound as bearing them, says the Gemara. Yered, who is this child called Yered that Batya gives birth to? Zeh Moshe, this is called Moshe. Lama nikra shemo Yered, why is he called Yered? Shiyar lem Yisrael man biyamav, because the man descended during his time. Gedur, why is he called Gedur? Shagad b'ritz adem shiyisrael, because he sealed up the breaches of Israel. Chiver, why is he called Chiver? Shechibert Yisrael levim shuvashamayim, because he connected the Jews to their father in heaven. Sucha, why is he called Socha? Shnasilem Yisrael sukazuka, because he brought down divine presence and providence like a canopy. Yekutiel, why is he called Yekutiel? Shekav Yisrael le'el biyamav, because he helped the Jews hope for God during his days. So Noach, why is he called Zenoach? She is Nechad Modem Shal Yisrael, because he cast aside the sins of Israel. Avi, 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 why is he being called not just these six names, but he's called the father of, the father of, the father of, because he was Av B'Torah, Av B'Chochma, Av B'Neviyut, the father in law, in wisdom, and in prophecy. Ve'ele b'nei Batya shelakach Mered, and at the end of this verse it said that these are the children of Batya who married Mered, v'chi Mered Shemo, she didn't marry Mered, hala Kalev Shemo, she married Kalev. And here we get given another defense of her reputation, or I guess depiction of it. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, Yekadosh Baruch Hu said, Yavo Kalev. Kalev, what was Kalev known for having done? Important and heroic? He objected to the Meraglim. He stood out and he rebelled against them. Why is so? Yavo Kalev. Kalev should come Shemared by Yitzad Meraglim, who rebelled against the spies. V'yisad about Parashemared b'glu b'edaviah, and he should marry this rebel who objected to her father's idolatry. So that was all a parenthesis to say, what is the definition of a Jew? A Jew is somebody who objects to idolatry, and we say Batya is an epitome of this, who rejected her father's idolatry. Kalev is a suggestion associated with this, as he rebels against the advice of the spies, and a long, complicated notion about who Moses was as well.
Sounds like Rachel.
Sounds like Rachel?
Like Rivka.
What do you mean?
Who rejected her father's... And Rachel.
Oh, that, right, that's interesting. There are other examples we could use. I guess they're not called Judean, so we can't use that as a proof text, but that's helpful.
It's also interesting that Moshe's called Chever. Isn't that the name for...
Yitro? Yitro's got a number of different names, and it's complicated. For some reason, I don't know if you've heard this before, I just saw it last week somewhere. Ibn Ezra, bless you, Ibn Ezra thinks Yitro is actually the name of Zipporah's brother, of Moses' brother-in-law. And Reuel is his father-in-law, and Yitro is a completely different person. Anyone ever seen this before? Familiar with this? Larry has. Moses. Yitro with Zipporah's brother, and he's called Choten Moshe. The Choten can mean brother-in-law. That was in Ibn Ezra's view, and Reuel is the name used for the father-in-law. Anyway, so names are complicated, and identities complicated. Okay. Yeah.
I always thought that Ishimini also meant that he was right-handed.
That's one resolution. He's right-handed. It's not brought up here. No. Okay. So let's go back to the Megillah. We've now said Mordechai's names indicate that his persona was that he rallied the people to prayer. Asher Haglam Yerushalayim. We are probably familiar with the tune. Asher Haglam Yerushalayim. I think we already said a couple of weeks ago, why do we use the tune for Eicha during the Megillah?
Destruction is potential.
Right, so that's the real answer. The answer everybody else gives is we use the tune so that Yekis can enjoy Purim too. Because you hear that tune, you're like, oh, that feels good. A little bit of angst. So, Asher Haglam Yerushalayim, they were exiled from Jerusalem, and it says twice in that pasuk, someone who learns the Megillah will have to fill me in, Asher Haglam Yerushalayim, Asher Haglata, so it says twice in the verse that they were exiled from Jerusalem. Why does it say it twice? Shagalim Ha'atzmot suggests Mordechai actually was not on the list of those who were exiled. He was allowed to remain, but he exiled himself. He said, I'm going with the people. I'm not going to kind of let them get sent off and stay home myself. So again, that tells you some insight into Mordechai. V'yomenet Hadassah, and he raised a Hadassah. Currently, Hadassah v'klari Esther. Okay, so we've got, on the one hand, Mordechai is called Benjamin, he's called Judah. Who is he? Now we've got Esther, who's sometimes called Hadassah, sometimes called Esther. Let's sort out this identity. Tanya, it was taught. Rav Meir said, we're going to have, again, four different solutions to what was her actual name. Is it Esther or was it Hadassah? And if it's not the other one, why are we using them interchangeably? Esther Shema. Rav Meir says her name was Esther. V'lamanikos Shema Hadassah. Why do we call her Hadassah? And if I were to tell you, you know, what would you think Hadassah or Myrtle stands in as a metaphor, what might you say? What would that communicate? Why would I give you the nickname Myrtle? I don't know, Harry Potter, Moaning Myrtle, we'll leave that aside. So let's see. Al Shem Tzadikim Nikru Hadassim. So the first view, Rav Meir says, is because Tzadikim, the righteous, are referred to as myrtles, and he's not going to give a reason other than a proof text. As it says, V'omed Ben Hadassim, there's a vision right at the start of the book of Zechariah, where he sees a figure riding on a horse among the myrtles, and it's understood that this is an angelic or divine presence. So it must mean that the myrtles are the righteous. So she's called Hadassah because she's righteous. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Hadassah Shema. Her name was Hadassah, not Esther. V'lama shekra Esther. And why do we call her Esther sometimes? What does Esther infer? Hiddenness or secrets. So Hashem Shaita Misteret Devareha. So the first answer is she's called Esther because she was secretive. Shneema in Esther Megedet Dama. She did not reveal her identity. That's why she's called Esther occasionally, which would be a giveaway. You know, if you say, hey, Esther, hey, secret keeper. So, well, what are you keeping secret? Her name was Hadass. Esther. Why is she called Esther? A different answer. Shari Umot HaOlam, because the nations of the world, Koinata Hashem Istar. For any of you are familiar with Persian, Ishtar is Say again?
It's a goddess.
It is the name of a goddess, but it was also identified not just as a name for a goddess, but it was the word meaning moon, in the same way that there are some celestial bodies that have got names referred to as gods from other traditions. So they would say she's as beautiful as the moon, and they would call her Ishtar for that, and that's why they called her Esther, even though her name, Jewish name, was Hadassah. But Hazayim ibn Isaac said, Esther, you want to know why she was called a myrtle? Is a myrtle a very, very big tree? Is it a tiny, tiny, tiny tree?
No.
No, so she was average height. Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Goldilocks. So Esther, lo arucha velo katsara. She wasn't very tall and she wasn't very short. Ela benonit kadasa. But she was average, like a myrtle. Again, that feels like a stretch, which indicates that there's something more at stake here than just, meh, she was average. Meaning, if I were to say, give me an average tree, you would say, oh, a myrtle. But that's his assumption, that she's only called Hadassah because she was unassuming, average, and to some degree, this is an insight into her character now that kind of we think about it, she was not an outstanding, charismatic figure who was kind of jumping at the chance to be a hero. She was quiet, she was unassuming. Maybe the reference, she wasn't very tall, very short. It's like if you're walking along the street and you saw an olive tree, in Jamaica States, you might kind of be arrested by that and think, well, that's unusual. There's an olive tree here. And if you saw a grand oak, you might also be, walking through Cunningham Park. There are some large trees. You walk past a bush, it's like, every five steps there's a bush, not paying any attention. That's what Esther was. She wasn't very small. She wasn't very tall. She didn't stand out. Rabbi Shubben Karacha Omer. Rabbi Shubben Karacha says, you know why she's called a myrtle? What else identifies a myrtle? Not just its size. If you're thinking about what you see when you look at a myrtle, what do you see?
Green.
You see green. So Esther Yurak Rocket Haita. Esther was actually greenish in complexion, why she's called Hadassah. V'chut shel chesed meshoch aleha. It's not just that she was unassuming. She was unfit for this role. She was not going to naturally be picked as the king's partner. She was green. But there was a sense of kindness to her. And this kindness of providence spread over that let her succeed. And we're going to see as we go forward in the next few lines that there are many ways in which God intervenes subtly in the events here that make Esther a fitting partner, even though it wouldn't actually have come to be. We then go on at the beginning of chapter 2 to say, Ki ein la ava aim. She did not have a father or mother. And then it repeats, Vamot avi avi ima, and when her father and mother died, Lamali, why do you need to tell me that? You already told me she didn't have a father and mother, so why do you have to tell me? Oh, when her father and mother and died, she went into Mordechai's house. Amar Vachor Vachor says, Ivrita met aviha. It is stressing, not only was she orphaned, but she never had a father and a mother. And as soon as their role in her procreation was complete, they passed away. Which means, when did her father pass away? Yeah, after conception. Meaning that's all the father is needed for, technically speaking. So Ivrita, as soon as her mother conceived, mate Avi, her father passed away. How long is the mother needed for? Until birth. So Yalada, when she was born, mate Ima, the mother passed away. So she had no relationship, no connection, no role with her parents at all. It wasn't that she was orphaned and still had memories. All she knew was Mordechai, is what we're suggesting. V'mot Avi Ava Ima, lakha Mordechai lo davat. Mordechai took her for a daughter. Now, what is the relationship between Mordechai and Esther? It sounds like adoptive father so far. Any other suggestions that you can think of in tradition as to their relationship? Uncle, we're told sometimes, and that's why he took her.
Husband.
And this becomes complicated. Is he an uncle? Is he adoptive father? Is he a husband? We'll leave Freud to the side. But here we're now going to say this, the Gemara is going to take the definitive view. This was not an adoptive father. This was a marriage. She didn't have any parents, and Mordechai married her at some point. It says, when her father and mother died. That sounds like quite a young partnership. But eventually they married. Tana Rishon Rameh, Al Dikri Levat, don't say he took him as a daughter, Ela Levayit, took her as the kind of the homestead, took her as a wife. And how do I know that Levat can be read that way? V'cheinu Omer, we have this elsewhere, in the famous parable that the prophet Nathan, or Nathan, gives to King David, to David, he says, there was this poor farmer who only had one sheep, and there was this rich merchant who had hundreds of sheep, and the rich merchant stole the sheep of the poor guy and left him with nothing. At which point David says, kill him! And Nathan says,
you.
Yeah, I'm talking about you. Atahayesh. You're the guy who stole the poison. He says, ooh. That's bad. And then he says, Chatati, I sinned. But in the description that Natan gives of this poor farmer, he describes a relationship with the sheep, which is quite an intimate relationship. It wasn't just he happened to own, you know, a piece of property, but he had a deep relationship with this pet. And for those of you who are pet people, maybe you've got dogs, cats, people can be very close and be very attached to their pets. So this, Natan says, Vilarash, Ein kol ki im kivshach haktana. This poor person has a single, small lamb, Shekana, which he bought, v'yichyev tigdalemo, and it lives and it grew up with him, v'im banav yachdav, together with his children, mipatoto ochel. And what does this sheep do? It bleats. And it eats mipito, from his pita, eats his bread, mikoso tishte, drinks from his cup, v'cheko tishkav, and it sleeps on his chest. V'tila lakavat, and it is like a bat. At which point the Gemara says, hold, because it sleeps in his bosom, because it sleeps on his chest. That's what proves it's like a daughter. Daughters don't do that. They don't sleep on your chest. That's a far more intimate position. It should be read that it was almost like a wife to him, this animal. Hachanami Levite. So here where it says Levad, it also means that he took her as a wife. Full stop. We're now going to start pivot to her role getting picked. As the queen, Etshvana wrote, she had seven maidens. What? Yeah.
Is there a reason why she can't just be a daughter?
Meaning, why do we have to go through these hoops to say, oh, it must be a wife?
Yeah.
Well, there will be in a minute, because in a minute we're going to suggest that she goes back and forth between the homes of Achashverosh and Mordechai,
can
involving. So far, yeah, that could be. But what we're going to see unfolding is she's going to be involved in laws of Nida and other such things to do with Mordechai. So that'll come, that'll become clear. So she had seven maidens. That seems quite luxurious for this unassuming myrtle to pick seven different maidens. What'd she need all that for? Why might you act seven maidens?
For Shabbat.
Meaning?
That they didn't know which was Shabbat. They didn't know what was going on.
Right, you pick seven different maidens, so you know when maiden seven comes, today is Shabbos, I don't have a calendar, I don't have a watch, she's resourceful, and this tells you she's interested in Jewish observance, and it's also a way to reject the idea that she's materialistic. She wanted seven maidens. It's only as a means. Shaita Manoa Mona Ben Yemei Shabbat, so that she could count Shabbat. V'yeshnait Ne'orotea, and her maidens made changes for her. And the way it's read in the Pshat is they changed her, they did her makeup, they changed her room, they changed her clothing, but there's a suggestion here that they changed something else. Amar Rav Sheichila Machal Yehudi. They fed her Jewish food. So she's in the palace, and she's not disconnected from Jewish observance. She's trying to keep Shabbat, she's been given Jewish food. Shmuel says, no, what did they change for her? They gave her special food. Sha'achila Kidle de Chaziri. Which I think means fried bacon. If someone's got a better translation in front of me, tell me. Do you have the art scroll there, Sam?
But it says...
Fried bacon?
Fatty, hard bacon.
Fatty, hard bacon. That's what they gave her. Did she eat it?
Tosfos says no.
So if you look at the top there in that little... Right, in that little box on the top left where you got the Tosfot, the last two lines, Kidle de Chazeri, fried bacon... And don't think for a moment she ate it. However, if you look across to the right, you've got Rashi. All the way on the right says Lukute Rashi. And if you go into Rashi, just to the left of that, two lines down, it says Katle de Chazari, which is a different spelling. It says Bekunush. Bekunush, Shminit. Fatty bacon. Umitoch Unsa, and because she was forced, Lone and Shah, she's not punished. So Rashi indicates she did eat the fatty bacon. Tosfot says, Chas v'shalom, she didn't eat the bacon. We're just saying what they used to give her because she had a good relationship with her maidens. Either way, Rabbi Yochanan and Omar, back in the Gemara, the first one of the line is Omar, said, what did they give her? Zeraunim, they gave him her seeds or vegetables to eat. V'cheinu Omer, and we know that that's what was often given in place of non-kosher food from Daniel, because when the Daniel and his peers are in the palace, they're also given seeds or vegetables, so they don't have to eat treif. And for 6 months, she was put in myrrh oil. My shemen hamor, what is myrrh oil? Chiba Abba says, and this is going to be very helpful to all of you, sacht. That's what myrrh oil is. I'm sure you've now got a good sense of what myrrh oil is. Ravuna Amar Shemen Zaychlevi Shlish. It is the oil of olives that has not, that have not ripened. So it's very small, early olives that have been crushed. Is this extra virgin olive oil? Is that what that means? Virgin means very young oil, olive.
It's the first press.
It's the first press.
So meaning they're fully developed olives, but it's just the first press.
Right.
Oh, all right. So this is not what that is. This is when you've got small olives that have been pressed. Which is a very special kind of oil. Tanya Biyuhra, Omer Rabiuda, we've got a brighta that proves this. Anpukinun, Shemen Zaychlei Vishlish, and that's what this Anpukinun is. So if you ever buy this perfume that everybody says is fantastic, that's what we're talking about here. Vilama Sakinoto, why is she being lathered in this oil for 6 months? Shemesir, it has say, Ari, because it removes hair, Umadenet Basar, and it softens the skin. That was the purpose. So there's a lot of materialistic, and now we're going to paint Achashverosh, someone who is. Bless you. In order for this to work, for Esther to get chosen, it's not like she's just going to have to be a good conversationalist. That's not what Achashverosh is interested in. He's interested in material, physical encounter. So we're now going to suggest again, Esther's got these seven maidens so she can keep Shabbat. She's being in special Jewish food. At the same time, there are these efforts being made that she should be appealing to the king. So the first is she spends 6 months being literally softened up for the king. And in the Megillah, it says that the women would come at night, and in the morning they would go back. So the Gemara responds to that by saying, from the debasement of this wicked person, we learn a little bit of praise. The Megillah is insinuating that even though he's a horrific human being, this is one thing he did right. Which is shlohayim eshamish mitzato b'yom, that he didn't have physical relations during the daylight. He would only do it at night. That could lead to a whole separate discussion about Jewish sexual practices and recommendations. The assumption here, at least for the sages, is that the daylight is not a time for sexual activity. And at least this guy would be given the impression he had that same practice. For Esther noset chen, and Esther carried grace. As she walked around, what gives you a sense of grace? That every single person said, oh, she's part of our ethnic group. She kind of had this interesting appearance where, you know, she was kind of dark skinned, kind of, I don't know any other, her nose was a certain shape, her ears were a certain shape, yeah, this complexion where everybody looked and said, yeah, I can see that. Without wanting to be crude or too racial about it, there are times where someone on the news will be presented as an African-American, and you can say, they're calling themselves black, but they're not like black. I know people who have much darker skin, and if you were to tell me that they weren't African-American, I would equally believe that. But there are ways for complexion to be average in some way, and here the suggestion is Esther had that appearance where everybody would say, oh, she looks Persian to me, oh, she looks Median to me, oh, she looks Judean to me. So she had grace with everybody, which speaks to the base character of human beings that we associate with people who look like her. And she was taken to the palace, at Beit Malchuto, to his king's dominion, in the month of Tevet. Why in particular are we being told this? Who cares what month it was that she was taken into the palace to be picked? And the insinuation the Gemara takes from this is God again is trying to manipulate the events here so that she will be most appealing to the king. She has been softened up by oil. She is of a complexion that everybody identifies with her, and she's taken in the month of Tevet. What do people want in the month of Tevet, which is in the middle of winter? Warmth. Yerach shenene guf mina guf. So this is the time of year when people most appreciate the body warmth. So there'll already be a comfort in them being together before you even think about the experience of intimacy. If Yav HaMelech had Esther mikol an Hashem, and the king loved Esther more than all the women, tisachim vechesed lafanav mikol ha'betulot, and she got grace and kindness before him from all the virgins. And the Gemara again is going to now say there's repetition here. She loved more than all the women and more than all the virgins. Why this being repeated is two different things. Amar Rav. Rav said again, he's a very base person who's focused entirely when he thinks about a life partner on sexual experience. Because the Tom Tam Betula, if he wanted to have the experience, a sexual experience that felt that this was fresh for this person, Ta'am, that's what he would experience. Tam Be'ula, if he wanted to have a sexual experience that this felt like somebody with a great experience already, Ta'am, he would have that experience as well. So the king was being made to feel her appealing nature. She was warm in a cold month. She was appealing to everybody because of her complexion, how she looked, and the experience of their intimacy was always how he desired it, because of providence, it seems. And at this point, we're now going to get some of Esther's quality, that she, again, was secretive. Even though the king made a party for her, he made a huge party with the ambition that she would reveal her identity. The king is now curious, and he says, who are you? She keeps saying, I'm just a poor girl from the country. And he says, there's got to be more to this story. So he makes a big party, and then says, who are you? She doesn't tell him. Dali Karaga, he then reduced taxes on her and her family, Vilo Galilei, and she didn't reveal her identity. He gave out gifts to all the members of the palace court in her name, and she didn't reveal her identity, so we see how strong she is. And then it says that the king gathered all these virgins again, at which point the Gemara wonders, he's already picked Esther. What are all these virgins doing here? It must be Azel Shakalesim and Mordechai. He went to his advisor, to Mordechai, and said, she's not revealing her identity, this girl. What's your recommendation? Of course, you know, as an audience, we know more. As readership, we know more than Achashverosh. Mordechai is the husband of this woman. And he said, how do I know, how can I get her to reveal her identity? And Mordechai says, Ein isha mit kana'a, you're not going to solicit her complicity. You're not going to get her to feel really jealous and defensive and give up her identity. Ella, until you start engaging with her peers, meaning you make her jealous and you start having encounters with other women, she'll feel defensive and she'll start revealing her identity. Which again makes this a very odd moment where the husband is saying, why don't you sleep with other people as well so that you can get her jealous? Fafilo hachi, which she does, he brings these virgins back to the palace, lo galya le, but even so, she does not reveal the identity. At which point, if I was king, I was thinking, why isn't she jealous? Maybe she doesn't actually like me, but that doesn't go in that direction. But we know, she doesn't reveal her identity. Full stop. So now we've been given insight into Mordechai's name and character as a figure who appeals, makes the Jewish people appeal to God through prayer. Somebody who rejects idolatry, which we associated with Batya. We now got Esther, whose name we've identified as both Hadassah and Esther. And a little bit of the scene that gets her chosen to be queen. She is unassuming. She's secretive. She is kind of pushed in a situation where she is softened up. It's the winter. Her complexion is helping her. Things are going in her favor. And we're going to have a smaller side again in the red over the page, and then I'll pick up with some words from the Megillah again. So Rabbi Lazar says, my dictative. What does it mean when it says, Lo yigara mitzadik einav, that God does not turn his eyes away from the righteous? And here, this entire aside is going to suggest something else about Esther's character, is that she is a product of confidentiality. It is not easy to keep confidence. It is not easy to keep, I'm sure at points in life we've all been told something that we've told, don't share this, and maybe there have been moments where we haven't been good at that. We just needed to get something off our chest or shared it with someone who regretted it. So we're going to suggest that Esther's very birth, her existence, is the product of two instances of people keeping confidence, of keeping quiet when they wouldn't have had immense pressure not to keep quiet. So we're not going to get this. So what does it mean, Lo yigara mitzadik einav, that God doesn't turn his eyes away from the righteous? Bishchar tzniut, as a reward for the what we usually translate as modesty. In this context, we're going to be seeing it as the quietness or the confidence keeping. Shaida Baba Rachel, which we have with Rachel, Zachta V'yatzma Menu Sha'ol. Because of her confidence keeping, Rachel merited to have Sha'ol as a descendant. V'yitzchad Sniut Shaida Baba Sha'ol. And because of the confidence keeping of Sha'ol, Zachta V'yatzma Menu Esther. That's why Esther is born. So there is a genealogical line that produces Esther that in some ways makes her fit for purpose, that she is going to keep confidence, she's not going to share her identity, which is key to this story, which again suggests that there are strings being pulled behind the scene to make Esther the perfect fit, not just that he picks her because she's sexually appealing or racially appealing or she's just warm and it's cold, but she is designed for this to save the Jews. Excuse me. Fourth line. When does Rachel keep confidence? And if I were to ask you of a story that we know of when Rachel kept quiet when she didn't have to, what, anything come to mind?
When she sat on the
Truffaut. Oh, when she kept the Truffaut quietly, when she took them at the end, that's one possibility. Another one? When she... When Leah gets married and she doesn't share this with Yaakov. Which is an unusual case, because it actually involves a little bit of trickery on the part of Yaakov, but it saves her sister embarrassment. So when is she? When does she keep confidence? Last word in the line is Dichtiv. Dichtiv, it says, V'yaged Yaakov Yaakov ki achi avihi. Who? Because Yaakov told Rachel that he was her father's brother. Now, is that technically true, that Yaakov was the brother of her father? Who's Rachel's father?
Lavan.
Lavan. Is Lavan the brother of Yaakov? Of brother-in-law? Lavan was whose brother? Rivka. So really, it's his uncle. So it's a strange... Why does Yaakov say I'm his brother? He wasn't her father's brother. He is the son of his... of her father's sister, i.e. uncle. Why is he calling himself the brother? Ella, this is what happened. Now we're going to have the story. Amala, he said to Rachel, Minsavitli, marry me, please. Amrele, she said, In, I will marry you. Miu Abba Ramau, but my father is a trickster, Velo Yachadle, and you're not going to be able to beat him. So I would love to marry you, but this isn't going to work out. My father's going to get involved. Amala, Achiv Anabba Ramau. So he responds, I'm your father's brother, meaning I know how to deal with trickery. And of course, what has Yaakov been engaged in terms of deceit already? He tricked his father to get the blessing. He says, I know how to deal with human relations. Don't worry about it. Say again? Exactly, it's right up my alley. And this is a strange moment where Chazal have Yaakov saying, I'm the brother in deceit. Don't worry about it. And of course, the Gemara is now going to have Rachel, the innocent child, turn around and say, hold on a minute. Is it permissible for the righteous to engage in deception? Amalanj, he says, in, yes. Im navartit tavar, with the pure, you should be have integrity. V'imikesh tepalel, but with the crooked, you should respond in kind. Meaning, I'm not saying it's a good thing to be a trickster, but if somebody is unreliable, that's how you should operate with them. You shouldn't just be naive and turn the other cheek and let yourself be exploited. So I'm willing to deceive should the case require it. Amala, and then he says, okay, now that we've established it's okay to be deceitful at times, my Rumiyuta, what should I expect from him? What kind of tricks is your father going to pull? Amrale, and again, this is almost Shakespearean, Romeo and Juliet. They're kind of plotting on the side. We want to be married, but my father's going to get in the way. He says, okay, what's your father going to do? How can I prepare? She says, Amrale, I've got an older sister. He's not going to want to get married after me or marry me first. So Yaakov says, I'm going to know how to play this. I'm going to give you gestures or signs so that you can prove that you're you when we get married. Kimata Laila, when the night came, Amra Rachel said to herself, Hashta Michtve Achta, my sister's going to get all embarrassed. I can't have this. That, you know, he'll ask for signs, she won't know them, and she'll get thrown out. So she gave her the signs, and that's why I said, and it, behold, it was morning, and it was Leah. That implies that it wasn't Leah before that. It was just the morning and transfigured into Leah. Does that mean it wasn't Leah yet? No. Since Rachel gave her the signs, however, Yadad Hashta, he didn't know until the morning, and then he realized in the morning that it was Leah. This is why she was destined to have kings. Which again, we've established deceit is okay in these circumstances because you're dealing with a trickster, and here she tries to insulate her sister from shame, and because she kept the confidence of her sister, she is worthy to have the first king of Israel from her line. And what confidence keeping is there for Saul? Dichtiv, when he was first chosen to be king, which is a interesting story where he goes out and he tries to find donkeys, and along the way he finds donkeys, and then he finds prophets, and then he has prophecy, and he gets back home, and they say, oh, how was your trip? Did you find the donkeys? And Shaul says, yeah, I found the donkeys. And he could have then said, and you know what else? I also had prophecy and I was anointed king. He just says, yeah, I found the donkeys. That was a moment where, you know, you could imagine the pressure to say, you know, you won't believe what just happened. I just had a prophecy and I'm actually the king of Israel. Then they just sort of found the donkeys. And because of that tzniut, Dichtiv, it says, he never revealed what was told him about the kingship from Shmuel. That's how Esther's born. So we're given, again, some backdrop to Esther's persona. She comes from a world which is deeply attached to your sister, where you're not going to, you're worried about other people's shame. And you can keep the confidence in that context. You're not focused on your own love. You know, at that point, she could say, stuff my sister's shame. This is my betrothed. I want to marry Jacob. And she'll be embarrassed, but I'm going to spend years now not with the man I love. Romantic love is important to her. She says, I want to marry you, but my sister's shame comes first. Her care for family and other people vulnerable comes first. That's Rachel. And Shaul, at least at the beginning of his kingship, is not interested in flaunting his royal role, his political power, or his destiny. And those go into who Esther is as a figure who is average, bless you, average, like a myrtle, a quiet figure who's able to keep confidence, and this is her backdrop. Full stop. First medium line. Amar Rablazer says, Kadosh Baruch Hu posek, and now we're finishing up the second part of that pasuk. This pasuk from Eos said, God doesn't turn his eyes away from the righteous, and it finishes by saying, and he will set up the royal on a throne. So Kadosh Baruch Hu posek gedula la'adam, when God gives greatness to a person, posek levanav nevanav sof kol adoro. It is hereditary. Greatness, if you're given greatness by God, it is hereditary through the generations. Shneimar, as the verse ends, v'yoshevim lenetzach v'yubeyu, they get seated for eternity and get lifted up. However, the next verse in Eov says, "V'masurim b'zikim," and if you get chained up, you'll be in trouble. V'himigizdato kadosh baruch hu mashpilo, which the Gemara says, if you start getting haughty, though, God will lower you. Full stop. End of parentheses. Okay, just a couple more minutes. We'll move ahead back to the Megillah. V'mama Mordechai Esther oseh, and Esther did Mordechai's bidding. What does that mean? Rabbi Yemeshai tamara dan nidalach chachamim, meaning that Mordechai wanted her to keep the laws of Jewish purity. So she would show her dam nida to the sages to determine whether she was pure to return to Mordechai or not. So we're now getting this strange depiction where Esther goes into the palace, but she's not kind of living in the palace permanently. It's not the arrangements of the royal household weren't that, you know, every night they would have supper together and then they'd go to bed at 10 o'clock and kind of share a room. This was, you know, any of you ever seen The Crown? Even contemporary royal families, often the king and queen have separate bedrooms and you might, you know, cross each other every couple of days because you're with different engagements and encounters. So the assumption here is Esther would see the king when she was summoned. The rest of the time, she would go back to Mordechai's house to her husband. So she would show the dam nida to make sure that she was permitted. Kashaita bamna ito, just as she would bamna ito when she was raised in that home. Amar Rabba Balima, what does that mean? Shaita omedet mecheko shel chazir tovel v'yoshev mecheko shel Mordechai. She would spend time in the home and in the embrace of Achashverosh, and then she would go to Mikveh, and she would go back to Mordechai, which raises all sorts of questions of permissibility, arayot, relationship, which again the commentaries get into, is how is this permitted? And this has, Esther is actually used in this regard, among other figures in Tanakh, for what's called the honey trap. Anyone familiar with the phrase honey trap? So this is used in clandestine affairs when states have spies positioned in different places. And this happens in Israel. There are units in the army where they have what's called the honey trap. Any of you seen Fauda? I know it's not really a good time to watch such a show. It feels a little too real. But there are women who are selected from the army. Say, you're going to be an appealing person. You're going to be sexually alluring. So we're going to teach you Arabic. You've got the right complexion so that you can fit in. We're going to make sure you seem native. And we're going to put you in a position where the leaders of Hamas are going to maybe spend time with you and you'll develop a relationship. And that's what's called a honey trap. So does that mean that these people, that this woman can never have a real relationship? She could be in that position for 10 years. She can't have a family back home. So, of course, mentally, what does that do if, you know, you're sleeping with the leader of Hamas and then you go home to your kids somewhere in, you know, Tel Aviv? It's a very straight, that's the dynamic being set up here. If you, any of you saw on Netflix, The Spy, or familiar with the story of Eli Cohen, where he would, I can't remember when it was, but I don't think I was born yet. When was
80s. No, that 60s. Is not. Yes. No, he was hung in 69, 70.
All right, so I wasn't born. It wasn't. It was before the Six-Day War, because it was because of him they succeeded.
Yeah, that's why I was hung in 69.
Right. Right, okay. So that was before my time. But I saw the series on Netflix, which was played by Sacha Baron Cohen, actually, who's usually a comic in The Dictator and all sorts of other things. And he played it very well, actually, it seemed to me. And you have this kind of tension drawn out where Eli Cohen is spending a lot of time at orgies and other things in Syria at the height of the bureaucracy, and then goes home to his wife and children in Israel. And it's psychologically very difficult for him to kind of separate where he's acting and where he's authentic and how to play his role, because you can't act in a position if you're not being authentic. So it's very difficult for him. And here we get this sense that Esther's going through the same thing. Her complexion fits. She's been selected by the king. She wants to go home to Mordechai. She's trying to keep Hilchot Nida. She's got seven maidens, so she knows when Shabbos is. She's eating kosher food. This is not just, you know, a play that we put on and we get. There are details that go into it. She was months in the palace. And this was a huge amount of work on her part to put herself in that position. And in those days, Mordechai Yoshev Shahar Melech, Mordechai sat in the king's gate, Ketzav Bigtan v'Teresh, surrounded when Bigtan and Teresh got angry. And now we're going to be told, God is also laying bits into place here. So we've got Esther chosen, Mordechai is in place. And now Bigtan and Teresh get angry. It seems like a strange detail. This is being added because it's going to give us the ammunition later for Mordechai to help out. There are two times in Jewish history where God incites a little bit of anger to help the Jews, and it doesn't always go in one direction. On one case, there's one case where God gets the master angry with his servants to help out the righteous, and Manu, and where's that? Yosef, in the case of Joseph, what happens? Pharaoh gets really angry with his butler and his baker, sends them to jail, and that's what produces the chain of events that leads to Joseph's release. And then the verse Shneimar, as they remember there's a Jew in prison. Avadim, and there are times when God gets servants angry, Allah name on their master, to make a miracle for the righteous. Amon, who's that? Mordechai. With Mordechai, here you get the servants angry with the king. With Joseph, you had the king angry with the servants, but it's always in aid of the righteous. As it says, V'yivadad avar l'Mordechai. Mordechai knew what was going on. How did this happen? Rabbi Yochanan, Bigtan v'tereshnei Tarsim, how you? They were both Tarsians. And they were speaking Tarsan to each other. But when they said, since Esther's come to the palace, we haven't had a single night's sleep. Now, I'm not sure why or what's being implied here, but they suggest since this relationship has begun as palace guards, we haven't slept. And this is unsustainable. We're exhausted. We want to have a night's sleep. I'm not identifying strongly with this at the moment. Bar v'natil ares, let's get some arsenic. Basalfal put it in his goblet, Kadeshamot, so that he dies. So like we are done with being strained around the clock like this. We need to end this situation. And they didn't know that Mordechai was somebody who wasn't meant to be exiled. He was one of the senior judges from the court of hewn stone back in Judea. So he knew 70 languages. And Bigdan said to Teresh, but we've got different posts. It's not like we both had the same post, and if one of us goes, there'll still be someone watching here. We have different places in the palace, and if one of us goes to poison the king, there'll be an absent guard. How's that going to work? And the other said, I'll cover both, don't worry about it. And Mordechai knew this, and it's that led to him being able to foil the plan. He could say, I'm telling you, if you go to the left turret of the western palace, you'll find no one's watching that post. That's how I know that I heard what's happened, and I'm going to show you what happened. That's why it says, they found out the matter, and there was an empty post. That's how we know Mordechai knew it, full stop. After these matters, just a couple more lines. Amarova, after what? What does this mean? After these things, the following happened. Acha shabar kadosh baruch hu before the makah. The second chapter of Esther is telling us that in our circumstances, God will always have our salvation in place before the curse comes. As Reish Lakish says, God does not strike the Jewish people unless there is already a way to solve it in existence. Shneamar, as it says, Kerafeli Israel, when I heal the Jews, Nigla Avon Ephraim, I will reveal the sin of Ephraim. Avalamut Olam Enokem, but the nations of the world, say the rabbis, that's not how it works. Maganotov Achak Barlam Refuah, first he hits them and then provides the solution. Shneamar, as it says, Venegav Hashem Mitzrayim, God struck the Egyptians, Naguf Verafo, he struck them and then he healed them. I don't want to hold us longer than that, so we're going to stop there and we'll pick up Yivas Bay Nav. Because we're going to see, now we're going to get into Haman's head. We're going to get Haman's plans. We're going to see how he is the king of PR, of marketing, which often we think, marketing, what's that got to do with anything? But of course, we understand that marketing will have a huge impact on world opinion and our ability to defend ourselves. And here we're going to get Haman twisting facts to his ends so that Ahasuerus shifts his tack and thinks, no, I'm not going to have them assimilate, and in their hope of returning, we'll just destroy them all. And how he does that, we'll see starting next week, and then we'll continue. In the meantime, benching, and thank you again to our sponsors. Okay. Have a good day.